comments I gave him last time. Exam 2, I hope to hand back to you a week from Tuesday due to TAs having their own exams. There's a long problem set on the website. It's not all due tomorrow, but it is due next week. But I really would go ahead and get started on it and not let it go, because otherwise it'll bite me next week. Okay? So last time, we reviewed briefly Ampere's law, which is this idea that you have the integral of v dot dl around some arbitrary closed loop is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. And this is useful under particular circumstances where v dot dl is simple and perhaps v can be pulled out of the integral, so it's a calculable thing, and where you can calculate the I, which topologically passes through the loop. So this is particularly useful for cylindrical geometries surrounding wires or plastic conductors and that kind of thing. We used it last time to look at a different geometry, that where we had basically an infinite plane of currents coming out at you, for example. You might think of it as a current sheet, where if I look at a distance L along the sheet, that there would be a current density, which is basically the current per unit length coming out of you. So you can imagine having such a thing. And when we analyzed this geometry using Ampere's law, what we found from the symmetry of this situation, the B field up above has to all be going to the left. There's no up-down component. The B field below has to all be going to the right. There's no up-down component. You can get the directions by just looking at the right-hand rule around one of these wires, which tells you that up above it will be circulating that way, down below it will be circulating that way. And in a way that's sort of similar to the infinite current sheets that we had in electrostatics, when we evaluate Ampere's law here, which is V dot this distance, V times L plus V times L to VL, over the I enclosed, if this is a distance L, you enclose the I, which is times JL. So what we found was that the magnetic field is equal to this mu 0 times J over 2, and it has no reference to how far away you are from the plane, so it's like what we have with the infinite sheet of charge. We have a field that's uniform and goes out to both sides basically forever with that strength and uniformity. So we have the same thing here in this sort of fictitious mental picture. And then we did something interesting with that, which was to basically, within a plane, look at two sheets of current, one going one direction, one going the other direction. So this is coming out of you, that's going into you. And if you look at the symmetry of it, you have exactly the same solutions, except for the top one, the field's going to the left on top and the bottom on the, and to the right on the bottom. And for the one where the currents are going in, the fields are reversed, so they go to the right on top and to the left on the bottom. And if you can imagine this red field superimposing this pink field down in this region, it superimposes a zero. Similarly, the pink field and this red field superimposed a zero here, but they add together in the middle. So you get two times the magnetic field that we basically were looking at earlier. We solved, actually, we used the Amperian loop. And we found what the field is inside this thing, where what we've done, instead of thinking this is two current sheets, imagine looking at this situation, but now making it rotationally symmetric about the axis of rotation. And you end up with something that looks a lot like a slinky, which we call a solenoid. And we then used what we had learned earlier about these infinite current sheets, and we're able to solve the field inside the solenoid, which is a constant value throughout the solenoid of mu 0, the permeability of free space, times the current that is in one of these loops, but that keeps repeating as it goes around, times n, and n is the number of loops per unit length along the solenoid. So that basically is a packing fraction for how closely you pack the various loops. So this turns out to be a really useful thing in a lot of ways. Like we had the infinite parallel plate capacitor was a way of basically having a very uniform known electric field. Here we can have a region which has a uniform known magnetic field. The capacitor in electricity was also used to store energy, and it was used to store stored energy in the electric field, and you can use it to store charge. And the solenoid, we'll find when we put it in the circuit, it also will store energy in the form of magnetic fields in its region. So it, in many ways, is pretty similar to what we did in electrostatics. You okay with this? All right. So then we started a new topic, which is really a fabulous topic. It's one of the coolest topics in physics, actually. It's called induction. And the law of induction tells us that if we do something similar to what we just were doing with Ampere's law, except we do it with the electric field. So if I take a loop in space or a wire or whatever, and I evaluate E dot dl as I go around that closed loop, it's equal to minus the rate of change of the magnetic flux with respect to time. So magnetic flux is defined just the same way as electric flux, except instead of the electric field, you have a magnetic field. And that would be through the same loop. So that would be a measure of how much magnetic field, how many magnetic field lines sort of penetrate through that loop times the area of the loop. So just like you were calculating electric flux, do it with magnetism. And if we look at the rate of change of that, so is the magnetic field that's penetrating through that loop changing with time, then you get an EMF. This is sort of a fancy way of saying you're stepping around a loop like in Kirchhoff's law, for example. Kirchhoff's law is the statement, E dot dl is another way of thinking about voltage. If you have an E dot dl, that sort of E, remember, if I multiply it by Q, is work, or force, times distance is basically work. So this is a measure of how much work I do as I go around the loop per unit charge. So that's a measure of voltage. That's what I mean when I say EMF. And we know from Kirchhoff's law that if I do that around the circuit, I come back to the same point, I should get zero. So what we're used to doing, if I were to couch it in the same language, is that this integral of E dot dl is equal to zero. But now what I'm telling you is something a little bit different, which says is if we think about magnetism, there's a new element involved, and if the magnetic field is not changing, that's penetrating through the loop, we get zero, and Kirchhoff's law is always the same. But what this says is sort of weird. It says if there's a changing magnetic field in space, as I march around the loop and come back to the same point, I will have done work. So that this is not zero. So it's sort of a new thing. So if you know the flux and you have an idea of what the rate of change is, you can calculate what the EMF is. What isn't obvious here is the direction of the EMF, because remember, voltage has a direction, right? If I have the 9-volt battery this way or that way, it does different things. So we get the direction from Lenz's law, which we talked a bit about last time. And Lenz's law, and you know, until you get used to it, I think this makes no sense. But once you begin to work your way through it, you should actually find yourself going back in these problems and actually basically reciting this to sort of remind you of exactly what it's doing. Lenz's law tells us that the current that gets induced, or the direction of the EMF is induced, in such a way that it opposes whatever change is creating it. The change that creates it is whatever change is, whatever this change is, whatever is creating this changing magnetic flux. I could be making it stronger, I could be making it weaker. And so the fact that I have a change here isn't telling you which direction it's going. But once you look at the situation and you figure out what direction it's going, then you imagine the induced thing is a thing that would oppose that direction. Okay? And that's what Lenz's law tells us.
I think that will become more clear with examples. We can do a couple, but let me show you one thing that I have online.
So let's imagine that we have a square current loop and a region of magnetic field where the magnetic field is going into space, going into the board. So let's look at things at different times for a moment.
Let me start at the place I want to start. Okay, so we have a region of magnetic field, we have a wire loop.
Right now, there is no current flowing, and there is no flux going through this loop at all. So this flux is zero, and the current is zero, because nothing's happening. Now, as it moves into the magnetic field, look at what happens. So let's imagine it's currently moving. I just freeze time for a moment. As this loop moves into the field, you get more and more magnetic field lines penetrating through the loop going into the board. So you're getting a rate of change of magnetic flux, which is increasing going in, because I'm getting more and more flux going in. This will induce the current that fights the thing that is creating it. So the induced EMF that's creating the current will fight this change in flux. If the induced current will go in such a direction that it creates a flux from the loop that goes outward, because it opposes the increasing flux going inward as the flux moves in. So for it to create a flux going outward, it should rotate using the right-hand rule. I put my thumb or fingers around the loop. My thumb goes in the direction of the field and the inside loop. The induced current should rotate this way. And that's what's happening here. So as this goes in, what you see is that the relative flux, the flux is changing. It's at a constant velocity, so the flux changes at a constant rate, but the slope of this line is now increasing because I'm getting more and more flux in here. And the current is, I guess we call it positive current here, going around this way. So you'll note that as it continues in, the current will stay fixed in magnitude because the velocity is not changing. So that rate of flux change is constant. So the induced EMF is constant. Once it's all the way in, notice that the current stops. I am no longer changing the flux in this thing. Once it's in, there's no change in flux, so the current drops to zero. And even though I have a lot of flux, a maximal value of flux here, it's not changing. So there's no current. And then this applet is set up so that it reverses direction. And as it does, you see the opposite of what we just came up with. So using Lenz's law now, as it's coming out, as it's moving out, the flux is being reduced. So the flux that goes into the board is becoming less. That means the current that you induce should want to increase the flux going in so that it fights that change. That means that the current should be going this way in order to increase the flux going in. And that's what you see is happening.
All right. So if you want to play with this, you can do all sorts of fun stuff. It is online on the website if you want. Okay. So let's suppose I have a current here Let's say that in the plane of the paper I have a loop here.
Let me say that I am decreasing the current in this wire as a function of time. What is the direction of the induced current in this loop? Does it go clockwise or counterclockwise? Think your way through that one for a moment. One or the other. You can't do zero and not nothing, okay? Hands up if you think clockwise. Hands up if you think counterclockwise. Okay. Alright, we have current going this way. That will create a magnetic field. If I grab the wire, it'll create a magnetic field that is circulating like this, okay? It's going out and then in. So this current is creating a magnetic field. It's going into the board at that loop. So there is a flux going in. I tell you, I'm decreasing that current. If this is decreasing, then it is decreasing the flux going through this. If I decrease the flux going through that, I want to induce a current that will increase the flux going in, which means I want to grab it so that my thumb is going in, so the current is going to go clockwise. Alright? That's how you think your way through these kinds of problems. It seems really convoluted at first, but once you do several dozen of them, you should get the hang of it and be really good at it. So that when I give you five of them on exam three, you're no problem at all. Okay?
Okay, so then we moved on to the topic of inductance.
So inductance really is a measure of how a changing current can change the magnetic field in a circuit element, and that will have an effect on the EMF that's in the circuit.
So you can really think of it as having two situations.
One where the circuit talks to itself. So you can imagine if I have a solenoid with a current that's going through it, there's a magnetic flux going through the solenoid. If the current is steady, that flux is not changing. So there is no induced EMF due to that. But if I change the current here, then we know that the B field inside the magnetic solenoid depends on the current.
So if I change the current, I'm changing the field that's going in that solenoid, which will induce an EMF in the same solenoid where I have the current going.
So this will cause an effect on anything where that solenoid happens to be. Because the magnetic flux through the solenoid is proportional to the current, if I ask what is the EMF in this thing, that goes as the change in the magnetic flux with respect to time. So it's going to be proportional to this change in the current in this magnetic element in this solenoid. Similarly, you could have the same kind of effect where I have a circuit element here which creates a magnetic field which sends flux through this circuit element or this loop. If I change this current, it changes the magnetic field here, which will change the flux through here. So here I could say that the magnetic flux going through number 2 is proportional to the current in number 1. So the EMF that I get over here depends on the current that's changing here. Okay? And this is a little bit of a different thing, because you're now talking about one element talking to another. But in both instances, what you find is that if you change a current, you'll get something else going on, an induced EMF. So it turns out that the way in which the circuit will talk to itself, or the way in which it will talk to other parts or other circuits, is something that we call self-inductance or mutual inductance. Depending on how it's done. So let's suppose that I have just some sort of single element with a current. Phi sub m is equal to phi sub m is proportional to the current. That proportionality constant depends on the geometry of, you know, the solenoid or whatever the element is. So we use a constant called L. That L is the constant of self-inductance. And the EMF is minus d phi m over dt, as we've already seen. But we now rewrite phi m as li. So this is minus l di over dt. Or to just write it more clearly. If we have a circuit, instead of, remember in a circuit we have this symbol for a resistor, this symbol for a capacitor. If we have an element of the circuit where we have a lot of this inductance, that is L is large, so that if I change the current I get a big EMF across it. They do make pieces of circuits that you can put in. And so just like we sort of consider, we have an electric circuit, and we consider all of the resistance where that resistor is located, rather than worrying about the resistance of the copper usually. Here we can also put all of the inductance in a piece of the circuit. And the symbol for an inductor in an electric circuit is like a little spring or a little solenoid. So if we have two different pieces of the circuit or two different elements, different circuits, then we say that when one changes the current in the other and it talks to the in one and it talks to the other, we call it mutual inductance. So phi m is equal to a constant. So phi m in circuit element 2 is equal to a constant times the current in one. So if I have a current here, it'll create a magnetic flux in the space, so I'll have a magnetic flux going through this loop. If I change this current and I have more flux, then I'll have more flux going through this loop. So the magnetic flux over here is proportional to this current. And that constant of proportionality is m, usually. Okay? And we call that the constant of mutual inductance. It's a geometrical quantity that's actually symmetric
So if I ask, what is the magnetic flux in element 1 due to the current in number 2, I'd have the same constant. And sometimes you may find that useful, so it's good to know. If those are the magnetic fluxes, what it means is if I change the current here, because it changes the flux through here, I'll induce an EMF in the second. Or if I change the current here, it's a flux here that's changing, and I'll get an induced EMF in the first one. So there is an EMF in 2 by 1, which is minus MDI1 over DT. There's an EMF in 1, which is produced by 2, which is minus MDI2 over DT. If you are really considering very specific things like a solenoid or two solenoids, and you are asked about the inductance of one into the other or whatever, then you might have to fret over whether you're talking about self-inductance or mutual inductance. Generally speaking, if you're doing things in a circuit, you don't worry about that distinction so much. You just have, if I have a changing current, I'll have an induced EMF. And generally, you'll see this as the equation that's used for the voltage that is induced across that element due to the changing current. So usually this difference between mutual or M and self or L is just sort of glossed over. So you'll almost always see it just like that, unless the problem is really trying to get at that difference between it talking to itself or it's talking to some other part. I can see that there are at least a handful of you sitting there wondering why you give a crap about this. So let me try to give you at least a sense of why you do a little bit. First of all, you know that earlier, say when we did RC circuits, first of all, if I just have a resistance across an EMF, life is boring. Life is boring because all that happens is I have a current that goes through the resistor, V is equal to IR. If I sum voltage drops, I have a V, an IR, and it's just boring. If I now stick a capacitor in the same circuit, if you recall, we now have a V, then we have an IR drop, and now we have this Q over C thing that comes in, and Q is changing with time when I'm charging up a capacitor. So all of a sudden, when I put this capacitive element into the circuit, I induce a time change into the behavior of this thing. And if you recall, which I hope you do because it was on the test Tuesday, if I start out with an uncharged capacitor in an RC circuit and I turn the switch, it charges, but it charges asymptotically up to a certain value, and there's a time dependence, which depends on this RC. And you can choose the time to be very long or very short, so it adds somewhat more interesting behavior to the circuit. And what I mean interesting there isn't that I sit around and read about RC circuits all day. It's that it allows you to do things with it, right? And it would allow you to make an EKG thing work or make a defibrillator work. So it allows you to govern the time change for the voltage and the current in the circuit. So you can do neat things with it. Now we have a new element that we can put in the circuit. And it not only has, remember what made the time dependence interesting in an RC circuit is we have one element that cared about the current charge, the capacitor, but another element that cared about the current or the time rate of charge. This element cares about the time rate change of the current or the second derivative of the charge at the time. So it's now different behavior. So when we have a circuit that has a resistor, a capacitor, and an inductor in it, or an RLC circuit,
we now have a more complicated thing. If I sum up the voltage across that, I'll get, you know, an EMF, and then I'll have an IR, and I'll have a Q over C, and I'll also have this LDI DT. So all of a sudden I have, if I look at it in terms of charge, it's now a second order differential equation, and you have to now solve that. So mathematics is a bit more complicated. It is doable, and you guys can do it, and I don't know if you're... You should, when you're studying for MCATs, if you're doing those, or BATs, or whatever it is you might take, you should look and see if you have to worry about circuits with inductors in them and what their behavior is. Okay? I'm making a judgment call right now that... Although it's very cool, we're supposed to put an entire section of modern physics into this course. And so I have to cut corners. And I'm going to cut a corner here and not do RLC-type circuits. But I did want to remark, just to give you a sense of some of the kind of cool things that happen. You're not responsible for this, but just to let you know, without worrying about the resistor for a moment, if I just hook a capacitor, let's say I charge a capacitor, and I put it in a circuit with an inductor, so it would look like this, where this blue would be representative of the electric field. So I have a charged capacitor, which means it has a lot of charge in each plate, so I have an electric field between them. So I have energy in the system because I have it stored in the electric field. There it is. I now throw a switch, and I have it across an inductor. Think of it as a little solenoid. What's going to happen? What's going to happen is sort of cool. I have a lot of charge here. The charge will begin to flow. As the charge begins to flow, it creates current, which means I have a changing current. If I have a changing current, if I have a current in an inductor, I'm going to create a magnetic field. If I create a magnetic field, I'm going to get a flux. If I get a flux, I'm going to have an induced EMF. And that's going to end up fighting this change that causes it. So what happens is you get the charge begin to flow. As it flows, you'll reach the point where you're creating a magnetic field here. And in fact, as the charge flips all the way around, you'll end up having all the energy in a magnetic field in the inductor. And we'll talk about energy in the magnetic field in a moment. Because you have this induced EMF that's changing this, it'll cause the charge to flow the other way. So you'll have, say, positive charge here flows all the way back to here. So the magnetic field now lowers in strength, and you'll end up getting all the charge back on the capacitor, but now flipped in direction, and you'll have all the energy over here. And this just goes on and on and on, and what will happen is you'll just have the energy go from one element to the other, and it just oscillates back and forth. And we call these LC oscillations. And it actually will happen at a very particular frequency. And one of the things that's really powerful with this is that you can use this natural oscillation frequency in an electric circuit for all sorts of neat things. One of the things you could do, for example, is if I have a way of exciting the circuit. So let's say I put a little EMF that changes its voltage with time. When that voltage change frequency hits the same frequency as this circuit, you'll get a big resonance and you'll get a big spike in the power of the current. This is how, say, a radio tune-up works, where you have a radio signal, and we'll talk about how this happens, but basically the radio signal is exciting the circuit at a specific frequency, and when you tune LC to where it matches that frequency, you'll get a big spike in the current. So it's a lot like a mechanical resonance when you get on a swing. When you time your kicks just right, the amplitude of your swing grows a lot. So this kind of behavior allows you to, say, do tuning with electric circuits and things like that. Back in the old days, you actually used to have to spin a knob to tune a radio. How many of you have never done that? Probably most of you have never done that, I guess. So, at any rate, so you can get some really cool behavior with inductors and circuits. It is conceivable that the external world will want you to know something about that, in which case
you have the basics, and you'll have to pick up that chapter and figure it out when the time comes. But I'm going to not make you responsible for it now. I do want to talk about one other thing briefly, and here I think we will do some problems with it so that you get a sense of it. Let's imagine that I have a little solenoid, okay? And then let's say I have a very big one. So this has sort of N1 terms, and this has N2 terms. If I had it set up such that I changed the current in N1, which I can do with a little voltage, okay, I can put it across a little voltage. If I change the current in N1, it produces a flux, a changing flux, that penetrates into N2. But the thing I want you to notice is that the flux that goes through N2, or this one, is much greater because there are many more loops. So if I line it up right, it's the same magnetic field, but it now penetrates through a lot more loops. So if I have a small change in the current up there, it will induce a big EMF in this one. So I'll get a big voltage. So we make things that are called transformers. This way of having different elements talk to each other is a way of taking a small voltage and creating a big voltage, which is what transformers do. If you look at power lines and you see these big things that are out there humming that look like sort of squat cylinders about yay big or something, those are called transformers, and they allow you to step up or step down the voltage. So one of the things that we're going to learn in a little while is that if I were to take an iron loop, a magnetic loop, some sort of current loop, and if I put a chunk of iron in the middle of it, the iron atoms will align and actually amplify the strength of the field going through the loop dramatically. So I can show you here. If we look last time, we saw that. So again, I have a loop that is around, that is connected to a voltmeter. So if I have an EMF in this loop, it's measured there. And if I take just a simple bar magnet and I put it through the loop, I'll have a changing magnetic field which will induce an EMF. And if I have it go the other way, the magnetic field flux changing, then I'll get the EMF induced in the other direction. So Lenz's law of work, okay? So that's what's happening. Similarly, if I have a different loop and I make a changing magnetic field in here by creating a current in this loop, then you see that I can get an induced EMF. If I turn the current off, I get it induced the other way. Okay? Now, all I'm going to do is put a chunk of iron right through the middle of these things. The iron is not magnetic, so note when I insert that, nothing happens. But now watch what happens when I turn the current on that top loop. It's much bigger. The induced EMF is now much bigger. And it is because basically the size of the magnetic field is enhanced by the fact that I have iron atoms that actually will orient and strengthen the magnetic field, which we'll talk about more later. Class. All that being said, the reason I bring it up now is that transformers generally really look like this, where I have some small number of loops here. I have some big number of loops over here. and I surround the loops, or I make the loops around sort of an iron core that looks something like this. So the iron turns out to do something sort of strange. If I have magnetic flux in this loop, the magnetic field lines will sort of follow the iron and go through here. But the iron will also make a much stronger field for a small field as a small coil, which then amplifies the effect of the big coil too. So at any rate, when you sit and start playing a little bit with some problems on transformers to get the hang of how this voltage goes up and down, you may find they talk about having iron cores or not iron cores. And so that's sort of what we're doing. Just think of that as a way of enhancing the magnetic field. So I recognize that discussion's probably a little bit sketchy. I don't really want to waste a half a class doing these. I just want to give you a bit of a heads up and let you waste a half a class worth of time on your own doing problems, figuring it out. Not so much worth that time. So I wanted to talk about some stuff that I think fundamentally is sort of more important for our time here. So I want to spend some time talking about energy and magnetic fields. If you recall, way back when we were talking about electric fields and capacitors, one of the things we did is we asked how much energy it takes to charge the capacitor. And once we knew how much energy it took to charge the capacitor, then we knew that's how much energy was in the capacitor. And then, knowing how the electric field is in there, we were able to look at the geometry and figure out what the energy density was in an electric field. So I want to do the same thing now using the inductor and a magnetic field. And why this is so important will become clearer in a class or two. So just bear with me a little right now. So suppose I have an EMF, and now I put it across a resistor, and we will put an inductor in the circuit. And let's do Kirchhoff's law, walking across around the circuit. As we walk around the circuit, we might get an EMF. Then we'll have a voltage drop across the resistor that depends on the current. And then we'll have a voltage drop across the inductor that depends on the time derivative of the current. Okay? So we have this new piece in there. I want to multiply this whole equation. And we say this is just equal to zero because basically that started at one point. I come back to that point. Things should be at the same voltage. So I want to rewrite this. First I want to put the EMF on one side and the IR and the LDI of the DT on the other side. And then I want to multiply both sides of this by the current. And now if you look at this, you might be able to identify the physical meaning behind a couple of these terms. I squared R this term is the power that is being dissipated in the resistor. Remember, I squared R is one of those power formulas that we use for the heat produced in a resistor. V times I is another power equation that we have. But in this case, we have the EMF across the battery. So a way to think about that one is that this would be the power output of the EMF. So if you look at those two pieces, and they're both power, this is an energy equation. It's a power equation. It's an energy per time equation, which means that this term has to be the power going into the inductor. So if I have a changing VIDT, if I have a current changing or not, it creates a magnetic field in that inductor, which means there's energy there. So if I have a changing current, I have a changing magnetic field, which is changing the amount of energy that this inductor stores. So we have this term, which we've identified, which is the rate of change of the energy of the inductor as a function of time. The only place, if it's just like a little coil, the only place for that energy to be stored is in the magnetic field that is created by this inductor. So I will consider that to be the energy stored in the field, the use of the... It's power, so that's divided by time, because power is energy per time. And that would be Li di over dt. Or if I now sort of integrate by time, or I get rid of the time on both sides, then I have the differential energy in the inductor is equal to L times I times di. Or if I'd like to know how much energy that's in the magnetic field of the inductor, then I basically want to integrate the left-hand side from nothing up to whatever that energy is. And the right-hand side, I'll be integrating from zero up to the full current that I'd have in that inductor of Li times di. And that integral then is 1/2 Li squared. So, oddly enough, when we did sort of a similar calculation using capacitor, we found that the energy stored in the capacitor is 1/2 CV squared. Here, we have the energy stored in an inductor when you take it from zero current up to the full current, where the magnetic field is now greatest, is 1/2 times L times I squared, where I is the maximum current. So, like what we did with electrostatics, we took a very particular case of a capacitor where we understood, a parallel plate capacitor, where we understood how the energy stored related to the volume, because we got some idea of where the electric field was and what it looked like. We're going to do the same thing here, but we're now going to look at a special case for the inductor, which we'll take as a solenoid. Take an infinite solenoid as our inductor. And we know that if we have a current I and we have n turns per unit length, and let's just say we're going to look at a length of it with an area A, So I'm making a bit of an approximation that it's an infinite solenoid. We're going to use those equations, but we're only going to think of it as being L long, which is really okay so long as L is long compared to the area of things. Approximately okay. So we will use the field that we found for a solenoid earlier, which is that the magnetic field is equal to mu 0 times n times I if we're on the inside, and it's equal to 0 if we're on the outside. Okay? I'm going to define the energy density in the magnetic field as this strange script U times mu of B, U of B. So this energy density is equal to the total energy that's in the inductor divided by the area times the length, because that's where the magnetic field is stored. The area of the solenoid times its length is the volume of the field inside the solenoid. So this is going to be 1/2 times Li squared. I tell you it's little I, so we'll use little I here. Li squared over A times L. The magnetic flux that's going through the solenoid is equal to the self-inductance times I. Which is equal to the magnetic field times the area. So that would be the magnetic flux through a single loop times the number of loops per unit length times the length that we're considering. You okay with that? So we can use this expression to substitute in for L. So that means that the magnetic energy density is equal to 1/2 times, now we'll get a mess here, this B, the B inside a solenoid, we also have solved, and that's mu 0 times N times I. So now I want to substitute all this stuff in here. Let's see if I can do it right. We have the B, which is mu 0 times N times I. We have A, we have N, and we have L times I squared. So what I substituted in here for was this thing is L over the A times L. So lots of things in here. The A times L cancel. The N comes over here and becomes an N squared. And I'm carrying one extra I. L here is this divided by I. So that means that this disappears and that's a one. So if I did it right, I'm still missing something, I think. Not worth our time. I'll come back and fix it. I'm going to post it. I might have scripts and algebra. All right, so I'm going to put a squiggly here, meaning I might have made a mistake somewhere. I'm going to go by my notes because I don't feel like catching the mistake. So this becomes 1/2 mu 0 times I squared times n squared. And mu 0 times I times n is b. So this becomes b squared over 2 mu 0. And I will, yeah, so that's right. So we have to pull out a mu 0 in order to come up with the other two. So I will make sure that I clean that up and all the steps are right when I post it online. But what we get is that if we calculate how much energy is stored in an inductor, we take a specific form of an inductor where we understand the geometry, which is a solenoid, and we ask, if I take that energy and I put it through the volume of the solenoid, what is the energy density in there? Then what we find is that the energy density in the magnetic field is equal to the strength of the magnetic field, B, divided by 2 mu 0. And this now makes no reference to the specifics of anything we've done. It's a statement of how much energy is stored in a magnetic field. Just like what we had when we did the same thing for an electric field capacitor, we found that there was energy stored in an electric field. So even though we sort of just pulled this whole field idea out of thin air, we're now saying that whatever this field is, by itself, actually has energy. So it's a bit of a strange thing if you think about it a little bit. So this turns out to be a very important result, just like what we have with the electric field density. And it's also, even though we made some specific assumptions to get at it, it's general. Okay? You all right with that? Okay. So we're going to come back to general behavior of electric and magnetic fields and what we can get with inductance. But before we do that, I'd like to spend some time talking about magnetic fields in matter. And to talk about magnetic fields in matter, I want to talk for a moment about what we call the magnetic moment. So we define, if we have a loop, which has a current in it, we define the magnetic moment to be equal, I'll give just the magnitude of it, the moment, is equal to the magnetic field created by it times the area that it has. And if you imagine having, let's see if it's worth our time. So let me look at a very specific example for a moment. So So we have a three-dimensional space, and in this three-dimensional space, what I'd like to do is to imagine that I have a square loop of wire, or rectangular loop of wire, let's say that it's in the plane that's formed by the, let's call this the z-axis. Let's call this the x-axis and this the y-axis. So let's suppose this loop is in the xy plane for the moment. And now I want you to imagine that I take it and I rotate it around the x-axis. So I want to do that with this loop. So when I do that, I'll end up with something that might look a little bit like this. So, okay, you've got this thing rotated a little bit. And let's imagine that we have a magnetic field here, which is going straight up in the B direction. And let's say that we have a current, which is in our loop, which is going this way. It's hard to draw this. It's sort of hard to see it in three dimensions. So I have a flat loop. Yeah, I rotate it up this way. I have a current that's doing this. Okay, so that's the idea. Because I have a current in the loop, it will create a magnetic field of its own, and it will have some area. So we'll say that I have a magnetic moment. And the magnetic moment will be in the direction of the magnetic field caused by the loop. And the magnitude of that is then equal to this B due to the loop, which is a different B, times the area of the loop. Now we have two fields here. We have a field going up and we have a field that's going this way. All right? If I have two bar magnets that are like that, what's going to happen? This bar magnet will have one pole, attractive pole here. It's going to end up trying to force this thing to rotate. So let's look at this for a moment and think about what's going to happen. Let's suppose we have our eyeball on the x-axis, looking at this thing rotating, so that where our eyeball is concerned, what we would see is the z-axis going this way, the green magnetic field going like that. There'd be a current coming out at us somewhere over here. I should make it orange. And there'll be a current going in somewhere over here. And this will be the y-axis. So if we look at what this field does to this current, B cross I, I'm sorry, it's I cross B. Imagine I is coming out as you cross B. It's going to be a force going this way. But the current that's in here, I cross B gives me a current field, a force going that way. So this external field is going to cause a force that way and a force this way. I'm rotating about that axis, so what that's
doing is it's giving us a torque. The torque is trying to rotate this loop, because it's pulling here and here, it's going to try to rotate it back into the XY plane. Okay? So this field is going to try to rotate this loop back to where it looks more like the blue thing. So there's a torque on this current loop. If I have a current loop, very often we just think of it as a little bar magnet, because it just creates a little magnetic field. So you can think of this as a little bar magnet, you can think of it as a current loop. It's anything that sort of has this sort of, a physicist would call it a dipole shape of a magnetic field, something that looks like the field that would be in a current loop, okay? If I have such a thing, there is a torque on it if it's in an external field. And that torque, which I'm not deriving for you rigorously, obviously, that torque is equal to the magnetic moment cross the B field. If you remember your rotational motion, if we imagine grabbing the x-axis, or if we imagine putting our fingers along the magnetic moment and curling it into B, this torque axis is along the x direction. If we have a torque along the x direction, that will give us an accelerating alpha. It'll give us an alpha that's counterclockwise around this x-axis. So that's a torque that's going to take this magnetic moment and put it back into being a long beam. This is a sort of a long, horrible, dragged-out discussion about basically trying to motivate the fact that if I have a bar magnet or something that has a magnetic moment in an external magnetic field, there is a torque, that is an angular force, that wants to rotate it into being in alignment with the magnetic field. Alright? Classically, that's very smooth. Okay? If I have the magnetic field and I rotate it the other way, the torque is going to want to rotate it back. So when you mix this with quantum mechanics, it becomes pretty interesting, because atoms and nuclei can be thought of as little bar magnets, okay, the effects of the unpaired electrons and the protons and such. And if you think of them as little bar magnets, this kind of torque will cause there to be an energy difference between orientations of their little bar magnets one way versus another way in a magnetic field. That gets all quantized when you throw quantum mechanics into the mix, so that you'll have sort of the little bar magnets one way, and then if they can absorb a certain amount of energy, they'll flip. Okay, and that's sort of the whole basis behind magnetic resonance. Right, so this is a little bit of the classical piece that underlies that, okay? And I want to use it right now in more of a classical discussion of just how magnetism manifests itself in materials. Let's imagine that we have a material, and this material is made up of atoms or molecules, it doesn't really matter, but little pieces, each of which has a little magnetic moment of its own. Then in most materials, these things will be randomly oriented, because there's thermal motion happening all the time. So these atoms, these molecules are all knocking into each other. So if there is an orientation with a magnetic field from one, it's going to be randomly oriented. There, in these materials, you can imagine the strength not being enough for one magnet to orient one of the others or something. They don't really talk to each other that much, but they're all sort of effectively little bar magnets. If I take this material, and I put it in an external magnetic field, because there is a non-zero torque, there's a little torque on all these little magnets that are in the makeup material, what's going to happen is that I will get some of them to be oriented along the magnetic field, because they're little bar magnets. It's not a perfect orientation because they're not that strong, and there's still thermal excitations knocking them out. But the stronger the external magnetic field, the stronger will these things line up. As they line up, they act like little bar magnets, strengthening that magnetic field because they're lined up along the magnetic field itself. So it's like I have a force of little bar magnets. If they're all pointing in various directions, if I penetrate through there, I basically hit random magnetic field. But now if I do something that orients half of them one direction, now I'm going to see a non-zero field there, right? It's going to get stronger and stronger as more of them get oriented. So in this case, as B increases, then the torque aligns more and more the dipoles, and the inside the material increases more than the external field. So B inside gets increased. This type of material, when you run into it, these are called paramagnetic materials. You can have other materials where there is no little bar magnets, no magnets inside it at all. But you imagine that I have just a current loop in space, and I have a changing magnetic flux. So I make a magnetic field here in space. It will induce a little magnetic moment in this loop, and in fact, due to Lenz's law, that magnetic moment will be in the opposite direction from the field that I just put in place. So already classically, you might imagine that if I put an external field on a material, I might get some induced dipoles, and those induced dipoles might be induced in the opposite direction. There's a catch here. Classically, the moment I stop changing that field, those induced dipoles are all gone. It turns out there are materials where if I put it in a magnetic field, you will get induced dipoles. They will be in the opposite direction of the magnetic field, and they're permanent. They stay there as long as the field is there. So you sort of end up with this situation, and the stronger the internal field, the external field that you have, you'll find that the B in the material is weakened. And this type of material is called a diamagnetic material. Diamagnetic. And there's one other much more interesting material called ferromagnetic materials I'll talk about next time, but I'm out of time. So, have a nice weekend.